7-year-old Stanley Rafalco stepped out of his narrow 2-story house in West Natrona and skipped across the street to Abe Roth's corner store. It was a late summer day in 1919, and he'd been charged with picking up a pack of cigarettes for his father, which should have been an easy job. It wasn't. The labor strike at Allegheny Coal and Coke was more than a month old. Negotiations had stalled, and the tension that had crackled like new fire was threatening to explode. Rafalco sidestepped a trio of uniformed sheriff's deputies and slipped into the store. By the time he reappeared only a few minutes later, everything had changed. The afternoon shift, made up of what Union loyalists called Greek scabs, exited the mine and climbed the hill toward town. The deputies Rafalco saw on his way in were now arguing with a red-headed, middle-aged woman in a wide-brimmed hat. She was chastising the deputies for haphazardly firing their weapons, endangering women and children. Suddenly, a man in a gray suit stepped forward and drove the butt of his rifle into the woman's head. Then he did it again. The woman screamed and scrambled across the street toward the Rafalco's front yard. The man in the gray suit lifted his weapon and fired. A slug ripped through the air and hit the woman, the force slamming her body into the Rafalco's fence. Despite the protests of his now frantic family members, Stanley Rafalco crept toward the body, squatted down, and lifted the hat. The woman's false teeth lay in a puddle of blood. This is Nebby, a podcast about Pittsburgh's history, mysteries, myths, and misanthropes. I'm your host, April Johnston. And today, I bring you the story of Fanny Sellins, a labor organizer for the United Mine Workers of America, who led a group of Eastern European immigrants in their fight against Allegheny Coal and Coke in 1919. Her death became emblematic of the violence associated with Pittsburgh's labor movement, and with the way in which women of the day were treated when they attempted to enter a man's world. Let's get started. Fanny Mooney was born in 1872 in New Orleans, but her parents, John and Mary, soon moved their 8 children to the garment industry hub of St. Louis, Missouri. As soon as she was old enough, Fanny got a job in one of the factories. It's where she met her husband, Charles Sellins. They moved into a rented house and had 4 children. So when Charles died in 1910, Fanny had little choice but to return to the factory to support them all. She made $9 a week as a seamstress. Men, of course, made more, but everyone who entered the factory put themselves in harm's way. Needles on the high-speed machines routinely punctured fingers. Tar dripped from the ceilings, and disease spread quickly in the close quarters. In 1914 alone, the Missouri Bureau of Statistics recorded 500 accidents. Hannah Hennessy, who began working in garment factories when she was just 13, formed the Local 67 of the International Ladies Garment Workers Union to advocate for safer conditions and shorter hours. But she died of tuberculosis before she could organize much of a fight. Fanny Sellins was the next woman up. It wasn't surprising that national officials chose Sellins as Hennessy's replacement. Sellins had a reputation for tenacity. She led her first walkout just months after assuming the local's presidency. It was unusual, even frowned upon, for a local to strike without the international's approval. but Sullins wasn't much for protocol. And when that company, Marks and Haas, responded by rounding up strikebreakers and hiring Pinkerton detectives to intimidate picketers, the union immediately fell in step with the local, ordering a national strike. The standoff lasted an excruciating 25 months, but Marks and Haas conceded, and Sullins claimed her first victory. Then she immediately tried for another, calling for a strike of the Schwab Clothing Company after management cut wages from $12 to $8 a week. Like Marks and Haas, Schwab refused to immediately bow to the pressure, forming its own so-called union, and promising workers death benefits if they joined. While members of the local worked the picket line, Sullins took the fight on the road, speaking at union rallies, where she drew large crowds and raised significant amounts of money for the United Garment Workers. At one event, she told the crowd, "I'm prouder of this badge I wear than anything I have ever worn in my life." A line that cleverly praised the union and cut down the clothing companies simultaneously. Local 67 wasn't moved. Members had grown tired of the prolonged walkouts and what they viewed as Sullins' grandstanding. They ousted her in 1912. She appealed to national officials, who did eventually reinstate her, but the wound festered. On a trip east for union business, Sullins encountered a miner who knew of her reputation and pleaded with her to move to West Virginia and assist the United Mine Workers of America in the fight against the West Virginia Pittsburgh Coal Company in Colliers, West Virginia. It was a dire situation. The miner's working life amounted to indentured servitude. The coal company paid for their passage to the U.S. and then deducted the cost of their rent and their required and overpriced tolls from their paychecks. Their houses were little more than shacks, and many struggled to feed their families. Sullins' job was to furnish food, deliver babies, and tend to the sick. When Sullins arrived in 1913, she found a battle already underway, with the company and the striking miners playing a game of high-stakes one-upmanship. In one instance, mine officials accused strike organizers of cutting off the road that workers used to get to the mine, and they responded by blocking the only road into Colliers, preventing striking miners from accessing food and health care. Finally, United States District Court Judge Alston G. Dayton called all sides into his courtroom and ordered the picketing and the intimidation of non-striking miners to stop. The next day, in the midst of a nasty snowstorm, Sullins defied the injunction. She spoke at a rally in Wellsburg, West Virginia. More than 6,000 miners showed up and listened as she dared Dayton to jail her. "I want to say that a jail sentence holds no terror for me. While my conscience is clear, know I am doing right and am violating no law. I have done nothing wrong. The only wrong they can say I have done is to take shoes to the little children in Colliers who needed shoes. And when I think of their little feet, blue with the cruel blasts of winter, it makes me determined that if it be wrong to put shoes on these little feet, then I will continue to do wrong, as long as I have hands and feet to crawl to Colliers." As the crowd rose and applauded, Sullins shouted, "I'll keep him busy throwing me behind bars, if that's what he wants." When he learned of the rally, Dayton called Sullins and her union counterparts back to his courtroom for a hearing and admonished them, leaving his most scathing words for Sullins. "You are a disgrace to the womanhood of America," he told her. The attorney for the coal company, perhaps sensing Dayton's disdain for Sullins, drew her as a woman who frequented taverns and other disreputable places. He didn't mention that both he and the judge went to the same establishments. It wouldn't have mattered even if he did. In early 20th century America, women occupied a low rung on the social ladder. And outspoken women who abetted foreigners and socialists, and union sympathizers were often, or at least often considered both, were fair game to be knocked down a few rungs more. Perhaps nothing illustrated this more clearly than Dayton's sentencing. Other miners and union organizers charged with defying the injunction received 2 to 3 months in jail. Sellens got 6. While she served her time in a 15 by 20 foot cell in the Marion County Jail in Fairmont, the House Judiciary Committee scrutinized the behavior of Judge Dayton, uncovering a troubling pattern of decisions favorable to coal companies, among other ethical violations. Though Dayton ultimately escaped impeachment, the committee still issued a statement about his lack of judicial ethics. President Woodrow Wilson was also drawn into the ordeal when a flurry of letters and postcards hit his desk, urging him to pardon Fanny Sellens. He did, in 1916, but by that time, the strike in Collier's that had started everything was over. In 1893, the local lodge of the Amalgamated Association of Steel, Iron, and Tin Workers walked off their jobs at the Apollo Iron and Steel Plant in Pittsburgh's Allegheny Valley. They wanted a new wage scale and the right to establish work roles within the plant, neither of which company owner George McMurtry was willing to provide. McMurtry gave strikers 10 days to return to work. When they didn't, he hired a bunch of local farm boys to break the strike and marched them right through the picket lines. From that day on, the Allegheny Valley became known as Black Valley, one of the nation's most notoriously inhospitable areas for organized labor. So, of course, that's where Fanny Sellens headed immediately after her release from jail. She wasted no time. In her first 3 months in the Black Valley, Sellens filed assault charges against a violent coal baron and convinced a trainload of black strikebreakers recruited from Alabama to stay this side of the picket lines. But her services weren't needed for long. In 1917, the United States entered World War I, and patriotism prevailed. Coal companies settled with unions, strikes were forbidden, and the U.S. government handled all labor disputes. It was almost peaceful in the Black Valley. Almost. Resentment still simmered just below the surface. And as the war came to a close, coal barons and miners predictably abandoned their truce and renewed old grievances. The era's Red Scare made it worse. Many of the region's residents feared unions would ignite a radical revolution, akin to the Bolshevik Revolution of 1917 in Russia. The fact that most miners in the Black Valley hailed from Eastern Europe only heightened those fears. Though the United Mine Workers actively attempted to dispel radicals from their ranks, their reputation was already set. Allegheny County Sheriff William Haddock hired 5,000 special deputies, paid for by steel and coal companies, to break strikes in the Black Valley. The deputies' expectations were targeted and totally unreasonable. No laughing at deputies, no loitering in the street, no gatherings of 3 or more people, and absolutely no speaking languages other than English. Sellens couldn't sit by while company-controlled deputies stripped people of their civil rights. So she once again became a familiar figure on the picket line and a regular speaker at union rallies. And she wasn't only working for the miners. She began organizing activities at local steel mills, too, in the hope that unionization of the mills would lead to unionization of the mines. They needed each other, after all. coal provided the fuel that ran the mills. Selin's activities raised such ire in the deputies that one vowed, "I'll get that goddamn horn, son of a bitch, Fanny Selin's, before I leave the valley, if it's the last thing I do." His threat proved prophetic. West Natrona was a tiny town located on a bluff above the Allegheny River, 20 miles northeast of Pittsburgh. Locals called it Duck Town, after the animals that its Polish and Slovak residents kept in their yards. In July 1919, those residents, nearly all of them miners or family of miners, decided it was time to take on the town's other resident, Allegheny Coal and Coke. The company was what's known as a captive mine, meaning Allegheny Steel owned it and used everything in it to fuel the mill. Miners were asking the company for the typical concessions: 8-hour workdays, higher wages, and official recognition of the union. Nearly 2 months into the strike, negotiations were stalled and tensions were high. When Selin's and her fellow union organizer James Oates made one of their frequent visits to West Natrona on August 26, 1919, they found a gaggle of women and children gathered outside Abroth's corner store. They were complaining that deputies were shooting at stray cats and dogs, and that their bullets had just missed some of the children. As Selin's attempted to get the details, deputies walked by with striking miner Nick Sobeck in custody. That only fueled the women's anger. To help defuse the increasingly volatile situation, Oates agreed to leave immediately for nearby Tarentum to bail out Sobeck and file charges against the deputies for recklessly discharging their firearms. Selin's, as usual, stayed behind to comfort the women and children. She suggested they head away from town, along a narrow road that connected West Natrona to Breckenridge. Below the road was Allegheny Coal and Coke. Above it were houses. But they didn't make it far before they witnessed something worse than Nick Sobeck's arrest. It was Deputy Daniel J. Riley repeatedly beating miner Joseph Strzelecki over the head with a gun. Strzelecki tried to run, but Riley shot him 5 times. Oates heard the gunshots and turned back toward West Natrona just in time to see Strzelecki fall face first into the dirt. Selin's was next. Witnesses with competing agendas told different stories. Either Selin's saw Strzelecki die and urged the crowd to throw rocks and sticks at the deputies and they fired in self-defense, or one of the deputies ordered, "Shoot her too," as she gathered children in her skirts and ushered them toward the Rafalco's fence. But everyone agreed on this. The man in the gray coat, Deputy John Pearson, fired the fatal shots. Pearson's fellow deputies quickly loaded the bodies into a car, tossing Selin's on top of Strzelecki, and headed for the Allegheny Steel Infirmary. As they drove, one of Selin's shoes dropped from her body and fell into the street. By the time the bodies of Strzelecki and Selin's reached the infirmary, there was nothing to be done but call the coroner. The bodies arrived at H.W. Flick Funeral Home in Tarentum, where Steel Company physician Dr. George Baumgartner performed the autopsies. Strzelecki was hit 5 times, twice in the pelvis, once in the side, once between the 8th and 9th ribs, and once in the liver. Selin's had 2 bullet wounds in her head. Baumgartner described them this way in his report: "I find a depressed fracture about 1.5 above the left eye, also linear fracture, running to a point about 3 inches above the right ear. I found in tracing the upper bullet above the eye that it had gone through the brain, where I found it at the base of the skull. The one entering the left cheekbone I was unable to locate, after looking very carefully. The cause of death was due to fracture of the skull and hemorrhage caused by gunshot wounds of the head. More accusations came in a coroner's inquest on September 26th. Sheriff Haddock accused Sellen's supporters of mutilating her body, adding the third bullet wound in order to frame his deputies. The wife of a miner accused Mine Superintendent Norman Adams of handing out rifles and giving the order to shoot Sellens. Deputies claimed they shot in self-defense as the crowd launched rocks and bricks at them. Witnesses of the shooting claimed that company owners sent deputies to intimidate them and drive them out of town before the hearing. In the end, a 6-man jury claimed it could not determine who had shot Strzelecki and Sellens, though multiple witnesses testified they watched Riley and Pearson pull the triggers. The jurors not only exonerated the deputies, they praised them for protecting, in this order, property and persons in the vicinity. The Pittsburgh Press printed the jury's statement in the following day's paper. "We deplore and criticize the foreign agitators who instill anarchy and Bolshevistic doctrines into the minds of the un-American and uneducated aliens." That same month, steelworkers walked out nationwide. John Fitzpatrick of the American Federation of Labor used his precious time before U.S. senators to outline the reasons for the strike. Reason 1, Fannie Sellens had been murdered, deliberately, for the purpose of putting fear into the hearts of workers. Fitzpatrick held up the now infamous autopsy photo that showed a deep crater in the left side of Sellens' head. Steel company officials called the photograph a fake. You can decide for yourself with a quick internet search of Fannie Sellens. It's the second photo that pops up. Union supporters, led by James Oates and Sellens' family, eventually succeeded in pressuring authorities to reopen the investigation. A grand jury even indicted 3 men, including Riley and Pearson. But they were all acquitted in a 1923 trial. Not that it mattered. John Pearson never appeared in the courtroom, and he was never seen in Pittsburgh again. Thanks for listening to Nebby. This episode was researched, written, and produced by me, April Johnston. If you'd like more information on the music or research used in this episode, check the show notes or head to nebbypittsburgh.com. Don't forget to rate and review Nebby on Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. It helps people find the show. I'll see you next month when Nebby returns with more stories of Pittsburgh's history, mysteries, myths, and misanthropes.